Good afternoon. My name is Deborah Schwarz, and welcome to our Blog Talk Radio show with Dr. Sheldon Seldman, the Vivian Milstein Associate Professor of Clinical Surgery in the Comprehensive Breast Cancer Program. Today, we are going to be conducting the first in a three-part Blog Talk Radio series on what you need to know about breast cancer. In this, our first program, we're going to cover prevention and family history. In our second program on July 11th, we'll discuss what you need to know if you're diagnosed with early stage breast cancer. This will include the needle or the knife question and the importance of considering a biopsy before having surgery. In our third program at the beginning of September, we will cover what you need to know if you're diagnosed with advanced stage breast cancer. Before we begin, I would like to cover a couple of housekeeping issues as we are taking questions today. Listeners can call in to 347-539-5189. Again, 347-539-5189. Listeners can call in at any time during the program. Also, if you would like to email in questions, our email address is info@columbiasurgery.org. Again, info@columbiasurgery.org. We are also live tweeting with the hashtag #CUMedChat. Again, #CUMedChat. So if you would like to ask a question on Twitter, mention @ColumbiaSurgery and use the hashtag #CUMedChat. We'll try to answer as many questions as we can within the next 45 minutes. So welcome, Dr. Feldman. We're very happy to have you as part of our series.
Thank you, Deborah. It's a great pleasure to participate in this and to have the opportunity to share some information with the listeners. So before we take questions, what I wanted to do was to give some overarching comments about this area in terms of breast health prevention and screening. As a breast surgeon, my great preference will be to prevent breast cancer and not have to operate on breast cancer. So a lot of efforts are being put forward to really look for better ways to prevent breast cancer and certainly to find breast cancer as early as possible. The good news is that we are making lots of progress and that we do find breast cancers earlier and earlier and that we have some growing information about important strategies to prevent breast cancer. A lot of the ways to do prevention really are things that we know are very good for us in general. So in terms of lifestyle, diet, and exercise, certainly we all know that these are good things for general health and wellness. And it turns out, in fact, that particularly exercise and diet, low-fat diet, are very, very important, both for preventing breast cancer and also for reducing the risk of recurrence of breast cancer. So there was a very, very important study that was published in the Journal of Clinical Oncology in 2007 by Drs. Pierce and colleagues called the Women's Healthy Eating and Living Study, or WHEL, which showed that women who had diets that were high in fruits and vegetables and who had regular, vigorous physical activity had the lowest risk of developing recurrence of breast cancer. So we know that healthy lifestyle can really reduce the chance of developing breast cancer, and that includes exercise, maintaining good low body weight, and reducing alcohol intake as well. So these are very easy to recommend as a physician for general health, wellness, and prevention. Other things that we know about as being important in terms of risk for breast cancer certainly relate to family history, hormone exposure. Women who use hormone replacement therapy are at elevated risk. The simple way to think about these things is that the more menstrual cycle a woman has in her lifetime, the greater her risk of developing breast cancer. So women who start to have menstrual cycles at a younger age or go through a later menopause are at increased risk. Women who don't have children or don't breastfeed have an increased risk of developing breast cancer. So we have a long list of potential risk factors for breast cancer, and in evaluating patients for their risk, we look at all these factors to help decide how high their risk is and what might be the best way for them to be screened for an early diagnosis of breast cancer. So we know that the mainstays of our screening tools at this point, the gold standard still is digital mammography. We use ultrasound and MRI as well for certain situations, and we also think it's critically important for women to be aware of their body and to do self-exam. Many women find early breast cancer on their own by paying attention to a change in their breast. And the things that we're looking for would be a new lump that develops, a discharge from the nipple, irregularity or rash-like on the skin, or an unusual pain. These things can prompt early evaluation and early diagnosis. So I think, just again, to give you sort of an overview of what we're going to be talking about, again, my favorite topic, really preventing breast cancer, because that really that's what we want to do. We want to be preventing this disease rather than treating it. So, Deborah, I'm ready to take some questions if you have some.
Okay, thank you. That was fabulous. So the first question we have is, if a doctor finds something during a screening test, how safe is it to wait before intervening?
Right. So it depends a little bit. So the screening tests that we generally refer to would be either a mammogram or sonogram. And the way we kind of grade the results or potential abnormalities on these tests is something called the BI-RADS system. So breast imaging, reporting, and data system. The BI-RADS score can be either 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5. A BI-RADS 0 means that the imaging studies are not really certain whether there's an issue or not, and some additional studies should be done, perhaps a more detailed mammogram, perhaps a sonogram, or perhaps an MRI. A BI-RADS 1 and 2 are really normal. BI-RADS 3 means that the risk of breast cancer is about 2%. So there's some suspicion, but extremely unlikely that it's going to be a cancer, and those patients typically will just be followed. BI-RADS 4 or 5 means that there's a very, very high likelihood that there is a breast cancer, and typically in that situation, we would recommend a type of biopsy rather than waiting and watching. A general guideline that we give to patients, certainly premenopausal women, that if they notice, for example, that they have found a lump in their breast that's new, many of these lumps, 90% of them, will be benign, and most of them will resolve when the woman goes through her next menstrual cycle. So it is safe to wait for the next menstrual cycle to occur, and if the lump has not resolved, to then seek medical attention.
Thank you very much. That was very clear. So what are the recommended screening schedules for breast cancer based on personal history?
So for patients with no risk factors for breast cancer, that meaning no family history, no prior diagnosis of atypical cells, asymptomatic, we generally still recommend a baseline mammogram at age 40. There has been controversy, has been, you know, in the media quite a bit in terms of whether yearly mammography is still recommended for women between age 40 and 50. And that's where we have more of a detailed discussion with patients. If they really are not at risk based upon any of the factors we talked about, it may be reasonable not to do mammography every year between 40 and 50, but to do it every few years. Certainly at age 50, we'd recommend annual screening mammography. For patients who are at increased risk in any way, though, we do think that screening on a yearly basis starting at age 40 is very, very important. Now, the other piece of information that women don't always know is that the sensitivity or the accuracy of mammography can really vary a lot from woman to woman depending on the density of the breast tissue. So by density, we mean, you know, how difficult really it is to see the image of the breast well on a mammogram. So women who have denser breast tissue, mammography really is not a very, very sensitive test. So we don't want to rely on mammography alone in that situation. We want to use additional studies, including ultrasound or MRI. Women who have a very non-dense or fatty breast, mammography is extremely accurate and extremely reliable in being able to see breast abnormalities very, very clearly at an early stage. So we take that into consideration. So if we have a young woman with no risk factors for breast cancer who has extremely dense breast tissue, then the benefit of her having a yearly mammogram starting at age 40 is going to be very, very little. And potentially, mammography is our gold standard, but it's not a perfect test. There are false positives, we call it, or false alarms, where women are found to have abnormalities that lead to biopsies, which turn out to be really nothing important. So we want to try to get it right. We want to screen patients very, very carefully who are at increased risk using the best screening tools possible. On the other hand, not overscreen patients who are not at high risk.
Great. Thank you. Another question just came in. If a mammogram indicates breast composition category 4, what is the protocol for which tests should be ordered, such as MRI, sonogram, mammogram, and how often for a patient 65 years of age?
Right. So it's unclear. By category 4, my sense is that generally density is not characterized quite that way numerically. It's either sort of, very dense, intermediate density, or low density, or fatty replaced. So for arguments of this question, I would say that we'll say 4 is a very, very dense breast tissue in a 65-year-old woman. So density itself is a risk factor for breast cancer. This is actually very interesting scientifically. We expect that as women go through menopause and get older, the normal process would be that there's involution or some atrophy of the ductal elements within the breast. Now, it's within these ducts where the cancers actually develop. So we look forward to actually these ducts atrophying and disappearing with time and the breast becoming fattier, thereby reducing the risk of breast cancer. But some women, just genetically, or if they take hormone replacement therapy after menopause, they maintain a high level of breast density. And that by itself means that there's more active ductal units within the breast, so therefore a woman's chance of developing breast cancer is higher. So if a woman is 65, has very dense breast tissue, and if she has other risk factors for developing breast cancer, then ongoing screening would be important, and we certainly would consider using ultrasound as an additional screening test, or potentially even MRI if the risk was high enough. The highest group, of course, of patients who, in terms of breast cancer risk, will be women who have strongly positive family histories of breast cancer. Many of these women may have already been tested or should be tested to see if, in fact, they're actually the carriers of what we call a breast cancer gene mutation. We call this the BRCA gene. And those women have an extremely high lifetime risk of breast cancer. And for them, routine MRI surveillance is extremely important.
Great. Thank you very much. And just to help our listeners, is it fair to say that sonogram is equivalent to ultrasound?
Yes, it's just they're the same.
Different. Okay, thank you. So Cindy has sent in a question. I was diagnosed with lobular carcinoma in situ three years ago. All pathology reports came out fine. I don't carry the gene for ovarian or breast cancer. I am on tamoxifen for 5 years. Could you tell me how at risk I am still for developing breast cancer? Also, I would like to know how you feel about breast implants for a person with my condition.
Right. Well, that's a great question. So lobular carcinoma in situ is identified in a small percentage of women. The terminology we think is not very good because the carcinoma term really frightens patients to thinking that it may be cancer, but in fact it is not. We prefer the term lobular neoplasia. But in any case, it really means that a woman's lifetime risk for developing breast cancer is quite increased. So we would say to age 90, the risk would be between 25 and 30%. The average woman with no specific risk factor has a lifetime risk of about 10%. So it's about two or three-fold higher for Cindy. Now, in having taken or taking tamoxifen for 5 years, you're reducing your risk of developing breast cancer by 50%. So it gets you pretty close to maybe the 12 or 15%, which is close to the average woman's lifetime risk. So although you still are at some risk for developing breast cancer, the elevated risk has really gone down significantly by taking tamoxifen. So you still are at risk for developing breast cancer, but it has been reduced by taking tamoxifen. Breast implants, there's been a lot of discussion about whether this, in fact, is by itself a risk factor for developing breast cancer, and I think these studies are very, very clear that it is not. So there is no contraindication for having breast implants placed for a woman who is at increased risk for breast cancer. It can affect the technique of screening. So for mammography, for example, special mammographic views need to be done. We call them Eklund or displacement views that allow the breast tissue to be carefully still evaluated. Implants typically are put in under the muscle so that the breast tissue is still quite easy to examine and easy to image. Some women, if they are higher risk for developing breast cancer, then breast MRI will be used in addition to mammography for screening. So I'd say no contraindication to breast implants if it's important for you.
Great. Thank you. Anne Marie has sent in a question. Dear Dr. Feldman, I'm a 50-year-old female, and starting 3 years ago, there was an inflammatory process in my left breast with a palpable mass at the 12 o'clock position. Ultrasound was performed, and there was an abnormality detected in the right breast, which required core biopsy and ultimately excisional biopsy for a clean margin. Pathology was that of atypical ductal hyperplasia. During every six-month interval for 3 years, I have had findings that require aspiration and biopsy with solid cysts with debris and lobulated masses to very dense breast tissue. My oncologist is recommending bilateral subcutaneous mastectomy. Is that a radical recommendation, or, as he has explained, I have had findings at every evaluation in a three-year period every single time? What are your thoughts?
Well, that's a really, really good question, and a little bit complicated, but I think that just to summarize, Anne-Marie, you're 50, and about 3 years now that you've been going through lots of evaluations for benign breast processes. In the evaluation, you have been found to have what we call atypical ductal hyperplasia, which is not breast cancer, but is a risk factor for developing breast cancer, so it does statistically increase your risk. Now, I don't know if you have a family history as well of breast cancer, but that would be important in the decision process, because women who have atypical ductal hyperplasia and first-degree relatives, by first-degree relative we mean mother, sister, or daughter, who's been diagnosed with breast cancer, their risk goes up significantly much more so than a woman who just has atypical ductal hyperplasia. So that would be an important piece of information that we'd like to know about. Assuming even that there is a family history of breast cancer, your evaluations have really shown a benign process. So still your lifetime risk for developing breast cancer, although elevated, is not that high, and the consideration of a bilateral mastectomy would be a pretty radical recommendation. Now, one thing that likely will happen, you're 50, and you've had a lot of complicated fibrocystic changes requiring biopsies on a frequent basis, is that your fibrocystic problem will get better now once you go through menopause. So I'm assuming at 50 you may or may not be through menopause yet. Over the next few years, as you become menopausal, there's significant improvement in fibrocystic changes for the vast majority of women. So your clinical evaluation will be not as complicated. You'll have less lumps and cysts to deal with, so that in terms of surveillance, it should make your surveillance easier. One of the decision points that women often have to sort of answer, and it's a fundamental question when they're considering risk-reducing surgery, is what is the primary goal? Is the goal to be 100% sure that you never hear the words "you have breast cancer" in your lifetime? And certainly risk-reducing surgery will achieve that. In other words, if we remove the breast tissue, the chance of developing breast cancer approaches zero. But in many ways, the more important question is, what is the possibility that you could have any illness or impairment of the quality of your life by experiencing a breast cancer diagnosis? And the answer is that it's quite unlikely that for someone like yourself, who is undergoing careful surveillance, that if you were to develop a breast cancer, it's extremely likely that it would be diagnosed at a very early stage and that you would be cured. So this is the trade-off. I mean, considering prophylactic surgery, of course, can give many women peace of mind. On the other hand, it's obviously a major consideration to go through. So before giving you a sort of a definitive opinion, obviously I'd like to know more about your family history and your true risk factor beyond just having fibrocystic change and atypia. But from what information I have at this point, I think that is a somewhat radical recommendation, and you might want to have some more opinions before making that decision.
Great. Thank you. I have a question for you. If you have a strong family history of breast cancer, at what age should you start screenings?
Right. Well, that's a great question. So in terms of the family risk, again, we talked a little bit before. If it really is a very strong family history, then it is extremely informative to consider genetic counseling and possibly genetic testing. the ideal situation would be that a woman in the family who's been diagnosed with breast cancer, that she undergo genetic counseling and testing to see if she has a BRCA gene mutation, because that does greatly impact upon the other women in the family. The clues that a family may be carrying a breast cancer gene or a BRCA mutation would be if there have been women who've been diagnosed at a very young age, either in the 20s or 30s, women who've had bilateral breast cancer, any families where a man has been diagnosed with breast cancer, and any family members who've had ovarian cancer. There's a somewhat increased incidence of certain of the BRCA mutations in Ashkenazi Jewish populations. So that is very helpful, because if a woman is determined, so if your mother has had breast cancer and she is tested for the BRCA gene and she has that mutation, then the daughter would have a 50-50 chance of having that gene. So the good news would be, if the mother was diagnosed at age 40, she had the BRCA gene mutation, the daughter is tested, she does not have that BRCA mutation. That's great news for the daughter, because she is not high risk at all for developing breast cancer, and her screening would be the same as any woman. She would start at age 40. If the mother was tested and she does not have a BRCA mutation, then it means that that particular gene did not cause the mother's breast cancer to develop. So we would generally recommend that the daughter start screening 10 years before the diagnosis of the mother. So in that case, she'd be starting earlier, being screened at age 30. If we know a woman is a BRCA mutation carrier, we start screening even at a younger age, even at age between 20 and 25, we would begin to consider screening.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. So you had mentioned tamoxifen earlier. Can you talk a little bit about its purpose, and are there any alternatives to it?
Right. So again, very good question. So tamoxifen is a medication called a SERM, S-E-R-M, or Selective Estrogen Receptor Modulator. What that means is that it acts on different parts of a woman's body in different ways. So it acts on breast tissue as an anti-estrogen. It acts on bones actually like estrogen. It acts on uterus like estrogen, acts on cardiovascular like estrogen. So it has differential effects on different parts of the body. So many, many years ago, it became clear that women who were given tamoxifen to treat their breast cancer had a 50% reduction in their chance of developing breast cancer in the opposite breast. That led to a trial called the P1 trial, which was published in the late 1990s, where a group of women were treated with tamoxifen who were high risk for developing breast cancer, and the other group of women received a placebo. And the women who took tamoxifen who were high risk, who had, as we talked about earlier, either lobular carcinoma in situ or atypia or a strongly positive family history, had a 50% reduction in their risk of developing breast cancer. So it is truly an effective medication to prevent breast cancer. The uptake on tamoxifen, so many women who are eligible to take tamoxifen for prevention don't take it. I mean, some studies have estimated that maybe only 5% of women actually will take tamoxifen because of the potential side effects of the medication, which can include menopausal symptoms. There's a 1 in 300 risk of developing uterine cancer. There's a small risk of blood clots, cataracts. So clearly it's not such an easy sell to ask women to take a medication to prevent something which is theoretical when it can have some real potential side effects. The other medication that has been established to reduce the risk of breast cancer is a medication called raloxifen, which is kind of a cousin to tamoxifen, or Avista. This can only be used in postmenopausal women, so it's not available for premenopausal women. It has first used to actually treat osteoporosis, so it's very, very good for bone health. It does have essentially the same level of protection against breast cancer as tamoxifen, but with a lower risk profile. The other medication is a more recent medication called aromasin, which is an aromatase inhibitor, again, which can be used for postmenopausal women, which has been effective in preventing breast cancer, also has some potential side effects in terms of bone health issues. Now, we have there's active investigation of, let's say, other agents, some not medication-based, which could be really very, very valuable in preventing breast cancer. And we've studied actually four different agents here at Columbia, and many groups are looking at other preventative strategies. The agents that we've looked at here is, number one, is what's called polyphenol E, which is the active ingredient in green tea, so it's green tea extract. We've looked at vitamin D. We're looking at metformin, which is a medication used to treat diabetes, but in low dose can be used, we believe, to perhaps prevent breast cancer because there's a very close relationship between the development of breast cancer and insulin levels in the blood. And omega-3 fish oils are being used. So we have very novel ways of looking at these agents where patients will take these medications who are high risk for developing breast cancer, and we'll have sequential studies of their breast tissue, of their density, and sometimes even needle biopsies to show effect. And I think it looks very promising. So I think there are many, many agents out there for prevention, many more to come still. And I think the goal will be, obviously, to come up with something that is very, very safe, has no side effects, and will be very powerful in terms of prevention. So we're not there yet, but we're making some progress.
Fabulous. Thank you. Before we continue with questions, I just want to remind our listeners that if they would like to call in a question, you can dial 347-539-5189, or if you would like to go through Twitter, mention at Columbia Surgery and use the hashtag CUMedChat. Thank you. So our next question is from Hannah. She says, there is a dispute on DCIS, whether it is considered to be cancer. I would like to get your opinion.
Right. Well, that's a great question. So DCIS is ductal carcinoma in situ. So just to explain a little bit more to the listeners, most breast cancers, about 90%, start in the lining of the milk ducts. Ductal carcinoma in situ means that there are cells within the milk duct that have changed. There's been multiplication of the cells, so that's the first step we call hyperplasia. The cells have become atypical initially. We talked about that earlier, atypical hyperplasia. The next step is ductal carcinoma in situ. This is the reason to consider treating ductal carcinoma in situ is that we know for many women this can then progress to what we call invasive ductal carcinoma. So the invasive term means that the abnormal cells have invaded through the lining of the milk duct and therefore have the possibility of traveling either through the lymphatic blood vessels in the breast to lymph nodes or through the bloodstream elsewhere in the body. So DCIS has no potential risk for traveling and causing any health issues for a patient. But because we know a certain percentage of patients with DCIS will develop invasive cancer, we often will treat most patients with DCIS basically to prevent the development of invasive cancer. And this is a fertile area of research to really come up with some genomic or genetic predictors of the DCIS so that we can tell which may progress and which won't progress. Now, we look at DCIS as not one thing. There are different types of DCIS. So we categorize DCIS into low-grade, intermediate-grade, or high-grade. And what that means is that when you look at the cells under the microscope, low-grade means that the cells really don't look very abnormal or very bizarre, so it barely looks cancer-like, whereas high-grade looks very cancer-like. Now, what we know is that low-grade DCIS, if it will progress to cancer, most likely will progress to a low-grade invasive cancer, and that the timeline for that to occur is going to be quite long, perhaps 10 or 20 years. A high-grade DCIS, on the other hand, often will progress to a high-grade cancer, and this can happen in a relatively short period of time, within a few years, an intermediate grade, you know, somewhere in between. So we use that information to help gauge our decision about whether or not to treat DCIS. The typical treatment for DCIS is surgical, is really removing the portion of the breast tissue where the DCIS is. We can treat DCIS with medication as well. Many types of DCIS are very strongly estrogen receptor positive. It means that they respond to medication that block estrogen, like tamoxifen or like the aromatase inhibitors. So we really kind of individualize the decision about whether to treat DCIS or not based upon the patient. And it's always, you know, a discussion about that. You know, an elderly woman who has a lot of health issues, has a bad heart, who has a small area of low-grade DCIS, it's very unlikely that even theoretically is ever going to cause her any problem, so probably not much need to do a lot of treatment. You know, a young woman who has a large area of very high-grade DCIS, not treating that patient, I think we're running a very high risk that she'll develop a serious invasive cancer in a relatively short period of time. So two parts to it: the genetics of the actual DCIS, the grade of the DCIS, and then of course, you know, the specifics of the patient really help inform the decision about whether to treat or not.
Great, thank you very much. Dr. Feldman, we actually have a live caller with a question.
Hello.
Hold on one second.
I just have one question. How should men screen for breast cancer?
That's a great question. So we don't recommend screening mammography for men. Even with a relatively strong family history, the yield in screening is quite low. So we think both self-examination and clinical examination are important. So at the time of a physical, certainly a primary care physician should examine a man's breast, and men should do self-exam. I am a strong proponent in self-examination for both men and women. I think that many men do find lumps on their own when they do self-exam. I think one of the unfortunate things for men has been there's not been a lot of awareness about the possibility that men can even develop breast cancer, so that many men, if they feel a lump in their breast, would think, well, it can't be breast cancer because it doesn't happen to men. So I think just the understanding that it can happen. 1% of breast cancers are diagnosed in men. So although it's much less common than women, we certainly see men with breast cancer. But in terms of routine screening, we don't necessarily do it. Even for men, if there's a family, for example, that has a BRCA gene mutation, so we would say that the men in that family might be at increased risk for developing breast cancer, and even if they're tested and they have the gene, still their lifetime risk of developing breast cancer is about 6%. So it's, you know, much, much lower than a woman who has a breast cancer gene mutation or BRCA mutation, where the lifetime risk can be 80 or 90%. And it speaks a lot to the penetrance of these genes. So just because someone has an abnormal gene doesn't mean that it's going to necessarily lead to malignancy. And that's where we think environmental and lifestyle factors really have an important bearing. Great question. Thanks.
Great. Do you have any further questions, ma'am?
You.
No, thank you very much for calling in. So we have another question. This is from Fanny. She asks, can breast cancer be treated only through surgery? Is it possible to treat breast cancer through natural means such as dieting? And also, I'd like to add to that, are there any alternative medicine approaches that could work?
Right. Well, this question comes up a lot. And, you know, I've been doing this for a long time, and I've had many, many patients through the years who really have tried to treat their breast cancer completely with non-traditional approaches. And the short answer has been that I would be very, very pleased to see success in that area, but I have not seen it yet. And I think that we still think it's very, very important to treat breast cancer with traditional modalities, of which surgery can be part of. Now, when we think about treatment, we think about surgery, we think about other options, medications, chemotherapy, radiation. We do have patients who we treat only with medication and without surgery. Typically, these will be patients who would be ill, elderly, frail, who really are not fit for surgery, where the risks of surgery, even a minor surgery such as lumpectomy, might be too much for them. If they are fortunate to have a type of breast cancer which is estrogen receptor positive, which about 80% of women after menopause have, then they can be treated very well with just medical therapy, with hormone-blocking medication like tamoxifen or an aromatase inhibitor, and that often keeps the disease from progressing and keeps it well-contained, and in some cases really will help it regress. So that is an option that we use that frequently for that specific subset of patients. In terms of approaching treating breast cancer using complementary modalities, you know, I personally do believe that it's extraordinarily helpful to not just treat the patient with the things that we know work in terms of surgery and radiation and chemotherapy, but also maintaining the strength of the immune system and general wellness being extremely important. So again, diet, exercise, mind-body approaches, Reiki, you know, a whole host of things I find enormously helpful in patients who are diagnosed with breast cancer, who really want to try to optimize their quality of life and their survival. So blending the best of both worlds, I think, is extraordinarily important. But in terms of treating significant breast cancer with just alternative approaches alone, I can't recommend it, and you know, I just haven't seen it work. So be pleased to see if that would work someday. But I think, you know, at this point, certainly using both approaches, traditional, non-traditional, really seem to give us the best results.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. And Dr. Feldman, we have another live caller on the line.
Hi. I think you touched on this earlier. This is in regard to family history and one's risk factor if a primary relative was diagnosed with breast cancer. The question is, how much does the risk factor change depending on the age at which that relative was diagnosed with breast cancer? For example, if she was 70 or older, does that still mean her relatives are at higher risk? And in addition, how much does the relative's lifestyle affect the risk factor for her relatives? For example, if the patient who was diagnosed at 70 was a heavy smoker, heavy drinker, and the rest of her relatives are not, does that mean their risk factor in regards to family history is lower?
Right, so that's a very good question. I think the age has some impact in terms of risk, but I think, so 70, I would say maybe not so much, as opposed to, let's say, someone at 90 or in their late 80s. So
okay.
I think if your mother was diagnosed at 70 and has and had not a great lifestyle in terms of you know, smoking, I still think that statistically, just the fact that a first-degree relative has been diagnosed with breast cancer really does significantly increase risk. It's interesting when we think about patients, for example, where there's a BRCA mutation, families that carry the gene, that in younger women now, we know that the age of diagnosis of breast cancers is typically, you know, we see it at young age, 30s and 40s. But the environmental factors are pretty significant. So actually we see it the other way. That, you know, we think the world was actually a healthier, kinder place in many respects, maybe, you know, 50, 80 years ago. So when a 70-year-old, and we think the critical periods of exposure to environmental factors that we think increase the risk of breast cancer occur during what we call the vulnerable periods. So actually when the breast is developing. So when, you know, when you're in utero and you're, it depends on what your mother's diet was like, and when you're a young girl going through puberty, that environmental exposures and effect of potential environmental toxins and contaminants on the breast tissue will have the greatest effect. So we do see families, interestingly, where there's a BRCA mutation, the daughters are diagnosed in their 30s and 40s. But the mother has not been diagnosed, and she's not diagnosed until 70 or 80. And that's because the world that she lived in, that she grew up, and that her breast developed in was actually environmentally probably a healthier place. So there are different ways to kind of look at the age piece of it. I mean, it certainly, I think, makes the risk a little bit less in terms of, you know, a family where a mother's diagnosed in the 30s, 40s, or 50s. But I don't think you can really factor it out and say that, you know, she's older, she was a smoker, you know, I'm not at increased risk. I think you still have to be considered at increased risk.
Thank you.
So you're welcome.
Thank you for calling in. One more question. Hormone replacement therapy, is it considered a risk for breast cancer in all women or only certain women? And if you stop it, does the risk continue?
Right. So there's been a lot written about this. There's been lots of discussion and I think a fair amount of confusion. I think to the present time, certainly the best evidence is that combined hormone replacement therapy, which was used, I think, for many, many patients for a long time, with both using estrogen and progesterone, after 5 years of use, there's a statistical increase in risk. Now, women who have had hysterectomies and then go on hormone replacement therapy and are typically put on just estrogen, something like Premarin, actually the increased risk of developing breast cancer is minimal to none. So it really depends on the specific situation. So I'm faced with this often in patients who are going through menopause. They're at increased risk for developing breast cancer. They have severe menopausal symptoms, and their quality of life is greatly affected by it. And I certainly think it's fine for women like that to use hormone replacement therapy, you know, for a limited period of time. you know, for several years or as long as necessary, up to 5 years, to help control their symptoms. I think what went on for many years, and, you know, I think many of, myself included, doctors were part of this. Before the studies were done, we thought that, you know, all women should go on hormone replacement therapy because, you know, it would keep their heart healthy and they'd stay healthy and young forever. And, you know, this was kind of, you know, just was not correct because the studies hadn't been done, and although it seemed like that would likely be true. So there were women who were taking hormone replacement therapy, combined therapy, for 10, 15, 20 years, with no endpoint, no reason to ever stop until these studies came along. So I think the reduction in the use of hormone replacement therapy, you know, has significantly reduced the risk of breast cancer, and it's actually been a big deal. But I think limited use of hormone replacement therapy is fine, and certainly women who've had hysterectomy, you know, taking Premarin for menopausal symptoms, no significant increased risk.
Okay, great. Dr. Feldman, thank you so much for your time. And listeners, thank you very much for joining. If you have questions that you have not as yet had a chance to ask, please email us at info@columbiasurgery.org. And as a reminder, our next show will be held on Wednesday, July 11th at 12 noon. And at that point, we'll be covering what you need to know if you're diagnosed with early stage breast cancer. If you would like more information about the comprehensive Columbia Clinical Breast Cancer Program, you can go to our website, www.breastmd.org. Again, breastmd.org. And to contact Dr. Feldman directly, please call 212-305-9676. Again, 212-305-9676. Thank you again for joining us, and we look forward to your participation in July. Take care and have a healthy day.